And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I've said this many times, but one of the great joys of working in the White House for me was my wordsmith sessions every day in which I led a meeting with my speechwriters, and among them were several of the principles of what we now know as Pod Save America. I got an early preview of it in this writer's room that we ran in the White House in the 2 years that I was there, and no one was more interesting or entertaining during those meetings than John Lovett, now not just a member of Pod Save America, but also the host of his own podcast, Love It or Leave It. I sat down with John last week in L.A. at the Crooked Media headquarters to talk about his career and about the work that he and the boys are doing now. John Lovett, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you in one piece. We were going to do this in March at South by Southwest, and you got deathly ill.
Yeah, we were doing Pod Save America live shows, and we did a Love It or Leave It show, and I wasn't really feeling well. And I thought, no, I'm going to power through. I've got Axe Files in the morning. And then by the time I got done with the second show, I was pretty sick, and I ended up in the hospital with an infection. But they cured it.
I'm glad you did that. I didn't want that on my conscience.
You had a very funny message to me. Because I was on like morphine and messaging you at like 3:30 in the morning. And I thought you'd see it in the morning. And I said, I'm so sorry.
You know, men of a certain age get up often in the middle of the night. So
I understand. I understand that happens. But I texted you and you said, health comes first, but this is very bad news for me.
Yeah, but luckily your buddy Favreau pinch hit for you. So it was good. It allowed us to talk about you behind your back. So that was good. So the great thing about this is I get to learn about people who I thought I knew very well. I want to just ask you a little bit about growing up in Woodbury, Long Island, mm-hmm. and your family, mm-hmm. who were in the box business.
Yeah. So my mother was a buyer for A&S department stores, and my father worked at the family business, which was Superior Packaging, which is a box factory out of Melville, Long Island.
It was a family business started by
my grandfather, Bernie.
And where'd they come from?
When
did the Lovetts get here?
Yeah, so they came in waves. There was some Ellis Island, some a little earlier, some a little later, all before World War II. As in nobody was
known right, in the Holocaust. Probably not named Lovett either, right?
They were Lovitch. I think got changed to Lovitch. From Lovitch to Lovett. I believe at Ellis Island, but that's where it was changed mm-hmm. from. So my father's parents met at a school for the deaf. And so they didn't speak in the home. And so my father's father, Bernie, was actually a taciturn man. Spoke very rarely and very briefly. And my grandmother was a giant, gregarious, occasionally quite mean woman. I mean,
yes.
So that's where my father came from. They never took a vacation. Bernie worked at the box factory all his life. My dad took over that business. My parents, I was born in Manhattan. We moved out to Long Island when I was 3 years old. My mother had no idea how a McDonald's drive-thru worked. And so she drove straight up to the main window and was told she had done it all wrong. As a child, I found that story compelling because I don't know, she just didn't know how she was new to the suburbs. Anyway, grew up on Long Island and went to Walt Whitman Elementary School and then ended up at Syosset High School, home of Judd Apatow and Natalie Portman. Yeah.
And we
it's so funny to talk about myself in this way.
If when we were there for the one of the presidential debates, you tweeted, last time I was this invested in a debate on Long Island, two kids were deciding whether to throw me in a dumpster behind Syosset High School, which was a great line, but it got me wondering a little bit about life for you.
Yeah, I think that I think that I think I was a tough kid to like. So I think I played my part in it, but yeah, look, I was a strange, insecure, awkward, closeted gay kid who I think let's say rough around the edges. So I think that I think I'm joking. I didn't have that bad of a run of it, but I had my moments of being like locked
in. There wasn't really a dumpster moment, was there?
No dumpster. I did end up locked inside of one of those big blue recycling bins. But the saddest part of that story is I think they convinced me to get in.
You and you were a debater?
Yeah, I did. I did speech
that,
and debate.
That alone can get you thrown into a dumpster.
Yeah, well, that was a place, though, where at least there was some...
It was that or the football team and you.
Yeah, well, they cut me from the basketball team. There was a moment where I was, before all the kids got taller, or maybe right when the kids started getting taller and I didn't, I had made the away baseball team. And the away baseball team is that, you know, the home team, they let everybody on the team because you just sit there and you never play, but it's fine. But the away team, making the away team is, they only have so many spots on the bus. So if you make the away team, that means you're one of the good players. And I made the away team. Anyway, all the kids are sitting waiting for the bus. And then all of a sudden I see the coaches whispering. And they come up to the whole team and they say, it's a different bus this week. Not enough seats. John, I'm really sorry, but you can't come this week.
That's awful.
Brutal.
That could. Yeah. Define your whole life.
And maybe it did. I don't know. It could be what guides me, propels me still.
And you went to Williams College and mm-hmm. you were, I had no idea that you were a math major at Williams College.
I was a math major. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think people think of ambition as like a higher order idea, that like, you know, that ambition is thought of as not being very primitive, like it's a sophisticated emotion, your ambition to achieve things. But I actually don't agree with that. Sometimes I think we put it in things, but people have, I think, an innate ambition that guides them, and they put it at the thing they're good at, or they put it at the thing they love, but the ambition is separate. And I think that I've always been ambitious, but I think I didn't know what to do with it. I knew I was pretty smart. I liked math. I liked jokes. I liked writing a bit. I wasn't that disciplined. But math was a place where I always felt like you're not just learning things. You're actually getting smarter. You're learning how to solve problems. You're learning a new set of tools for tackling the world. And even years later, when we were working on speeches, I always felt like one of my strengths was I could quickly, truthfully break something down. And I think that's a math skill. It is a math skill.
And quickly add up the number of words.
Sure,
also good.
Well, it was nice they added a thing you can just Alt W or something. But the that was a big part of college for
it's
me.
Just unusual because you think of math, you don't think of math people being great writers. I mean, it's like, it seems like two different parts of the brain.
Yeah, well, I think it is very different. You know, I don't think to be a speechwriter, you need to be a truly great writer. Obviously, it helps. I think you need to be good at a bunch of different things all at once. And one of them is being a good writer, but one of them is also being a clear thinker. I mean, the best speeches are speeches that are that translate an idea elegantly. And I think sometimes sometimes writing is complicated because someone's taken a complicated idea and explained it simply. But a lot of writing is people taking a simple idea and struggling to explain it in a simple way. And I think math forces you to really attack the logic of what you're trying to say, because you can get away with things in writing that you just can't get away with in math.
Well, this ability was evident in the epic piece, Rotating Linkages in a Normed Plane, your college thesis. What would it be like to live in a space with a non-Euclidean norm where length depends on direction? Could you turn around? will show the answer. We'll show that the answer is no. You tend to get stuck in a non-Euclidean norm plane. Although a triangle can be fully rotated all the way around, a typical rhombus with diagonal struts cannot. Very clear. Brilliant writing.
And goosebumps.
Yes. Yeah.
How inspirational.
What you see here are the makings of a great comic, is what I thought when I read this. And so you don't, when you're a math major, you don't say, okay, I'm going to go set up a store. I'm going to put up a shingle on my I'm going to have a math store.
Hire your math here.
Went to New York, and like other math majors, you became a paralegal.
Right. So I ended up at the end of college running to be the class speaker. There was a part of me that really, look, I think in hindsight, I think I had a chip on my shoulder, and I think I didn't have the best. I didn't have the worst experience in high school, but I didn't have the best experience in high school.
When did you, let me interrupt for a second, and because I should have asked you this earlier. You talked about being a closeted gay man, a young man. When did you come out?
I came out, I started right after high school. I started telling close friends, and then I got to college, and I slowly started telling people over my freshman year. I think I told my parents shortly after that. For telling my parents, I had a great trick, which I've since recommended to others. I tied myself to the mast. Because here's the thing. I knew I wanted to do it, but really what I wanted to have done it. And it was a really hard thing to do. And so I told my parents, this was a cruel thing to do, but I told my parents, I said, I have an incredibly important thing to tell you tomorrow. And then it was, and I said to myself, you know what? I've been struggling with this thing for so long. Yeah. Does that mean I'm going to drive my mother crazy for one day trying to figure out what this is? Is she going to be worried? Yes. Am I going to assuage her and tell her it's nothing bad, nothing serious? It's nothing to worry about even for a second, but it's big news and you can't find out till tomorrow. I did put my parents in a position of having to beg me for information for a day, but it worked because I had two choices come the next day: make something up or just come out with it. And I came out with it. So I've recommended that for people who are looking for that final boost.
And how did
that
conversation go?
It went well. My mother was, it went well. I think it was a little bit harder for my father. I think he handled it with compassion. I think he was of a generation where he wanted to ask questions about how I knew it was true and whether it was true and what it meant for it to be true. And my mother was wholly concerned about how I had been going through it alone. And that was a really good moment for us because she was worried about me, and that's what she cared about. And it was ultimately, I think, good for us.
You, among the many fine speeches that you wrote in the White House, one was the speech that the president gave when he signed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. What did that mean to you personally?
It's funny. I just wanted to do a good job. I cared about it. I wanted to tell a story. One of the things I think I did in that speech is I really was like combing for a good story about a gay soldier that wasn't about being a gay soldier. I just wanted to, because this wasn't allowing gays to serve in the military. This was recognizing that gays serve in the military. Mm-hmm. And so, and there have been gay soldiers from the beginning. There's I can't remember, his name doesn't come to me, but one of George Washington's lieutenants, or one of the people that helped George Washington, was a gay soldier. You know, it's part of our history. And so we found this great story about someone who did this incredibly heroic thing during, I want to say, the Battle of the Bulge. I don't remember, but it was just a tale of someone's heroics. And then that person 30, 40 years later, sitting down, the person he saved, and saying, you know, I'm gay the whole time. And the reaction, which was accepting, because when it's somebody you know who you've been through something with, the politics don't matter.
I have to confess, you know, I consider myself a progressive person, but I've, through all of this very, very moving and frenetic change in our culture, from what you experienced as a kid to acceptance, I really learned and found myself focusing on the experience of not being able to be who you are. It was really that debate, you know, when Admiral Mullen said, you know, I can't ask people to lie about who they are, about the essence of who they are. And I thought, that's a painful thing for people to go through.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's happening now that was in small part propelled by what happened with gay rights in the last 20 years is we're questioning what it means to be defined as the typical person. That the assumption about what it means to be normal was based in what it's like to be a straight white man. And so things that diverge from that were treated as different or as diversity, as opposed to and privileging the traditional position of straight white men in the military. And I think what we're seeing now with women, especially, you know, around what's been happening with attacking sexual assault in the military, what happened with gay rights, what's going to happen with trans people, is saying, hold on a second, simply because this one kind of person was privileged doesn't mean they're better, doesn't mean they're more deserving of a place, and doesn't mean they're the only ones who get to be themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. So you, getting back to your story, you're in New York, you're a paralegal, you're filling out law school mm-hmm. applications, and you're doing stand-up on the side. And is that what you wanted to do? Is that what you really wanted to do?
You know, I feel like I've always been pulled in two directions. I was pulled towards politics, I think because I cared about it. I think it was because it was an outlet for the things I was angry and scared about before I could be honest with myself about who I was. And I've been always drawn to comedy in some way. I remember one of my best friends, Sam, he and I were talking, and I told him, I said, you know, honestly, I think I'm funny enough to be a funny professional, but I don't believe that I'm funny enough to be professionally funny. And I don't know. And so I know that I'm going to write jokes for politicians, and they're going to be good because I'm good at that. But at some point, I'm going to convince myself that I should be in comedy and just remind me that this is how I feel. Like, that remind me that I can get convinced of something, but that deep down, I just don't believe it. And years later, after I went into politics, when I was thinking about doing comedy in LA full time, he actually brought it up. And he's like, you know, you told me to remind you of this, but you should know that I don't think it's true. And it was a really good moment. But at this time, like, I was pulled in these two directions. I was afraid, I think, to fully commit to stand up because, A, it took vulnerability that I wasn't capable of.
Yeah.
And
I think it's incredibly brave to get on a stage. There's nothing worse than a joke that bombs.
Absolutely. And I definitely did my fair share of bombing. But it's actually deeper than that. It's the vulnerability of trying when it requires not just going on stage, but begging for stage time, standing outside a comedy club and handing out flyers, trying to find someone who can put you on stage, trying to get your friends to go to the club because you have to get 10 people there to get the time on stage, all those pieces of it. And for whatever reason, I didn't feel strongly enough about fighting for that, which made me think I shouldn't do it. But that's what I was doing when I was in New York. By day, I was like temp paralegaling, filling out asbestos-related lawsuit claims, and filling out law school applications, which I ultimately realized that, which I should never have been doing. And then by night, going to open mics.
And you went and you volunteered for John Kerry.
Yes.
Were you always interested in politics?
I was. I liked, so when I was in high school, we had this incredible English teacher, Lydia Esslinger, who was the forensics coach, and I would write speeches and deliver the speeches. Oratory was that category. But I actually ended up having more success in what was called extemporaneous speaking, which was they give you a question and you've got 30 minutes to come up with the argument. And it's been my strength this whole time. Sitting down, writing for several days, coming out with something, I can do it, but the thing I am best at is very quickly solving a problem, very quickly coming up with an argument. I think that's why, you know, we can talk about it, but at the White House, one of the things I loved doing was when there would be those job reports that would come out at like 8:30 a.m. and the president had to go to the podium at 9:30 a.m. I loved working on those because all the ways in which I struggle to they go away. They don't
and
have
so
a choice.
I used to, when I was a newspaper man, I used to love dictating stories on Deadline from wherever I was. City Council did something in Chicago, mm-hmm. picking up the phone because you only have 10 minutes before the edition closes and having to, because there's no time for self-doubt or guessing, and it's pure instinct, and generally your instincts are good.
Yeah, I think you and I are very similar in that. I think that
people always say that.
Yeah, no, looking in the mirror. No, but I think we are, because I think that one of the reasons I struggle when given all the time in the world is self-doubt, which contributes to not being able to start, which contributes to self-doubt. And also just being passionate and struggling to get on the page a deeper feeling you're trying to connect with. I struggle with that. But when you got 10 minutes, when you got 15
right.
minutes, you don't have a choice.
Right.
And all you have is your skill. And the good news is I felt proud that that skill set was there, that ability was there to just call upon.
So tell me about the Cary experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I drove down to D.C. I stayed in a college friend's parents' basement, and I volunteered, and it was toward the end of the campaign. I think it's late August, maybe September, October. By then, a lot of the other interns had been dispatched to various field offices, so there weren't that many interns left at headquarters, and... you know, it's the old joke, you know, about being a painter. If you show up sober, they make you foreman. this is advice I've given to any intern I've ever met. Just do a good job. You will be amazed at how that separates you from the field.
And just stay sober.
Just and stay sober during the day. But I ended up, there were several hurricanes that year. There was like Ivan and a few others, and they kept needing statements from John Kerry to go to various places, like to, you know, the senator expresses his condolences to the people of Louisiana, Texas, Florida. And they just needed somebody to bang out those statements, and I did it. And so I ended up writing those statements. That led them to ask me, hey, write an op-ed or two. I didn't realize that Favreau was upstairs working on the campaign, on the speeches. So I think a lot of times I was writing something, they'd forward it up for a polish from somebody who was on the speech running staff, and he was one of them, sort of
right.
going through those things. I would just see it come back later and be like, huh, I don't understand how these differences are made because of the, what's that principle that says your incompetence means you can't see your incompetence?
I don't know.
I was a new writer, I mm-hmm. couldn't see why it was better. I knew it was instinctively, but I was like, huh, it's different, because
mm-hmm.
I still had to learn what it meant for it to be better. But
well, you work with Favs now, maybe he can explain it to you.
You know, he never wants to tell me. He wants to protect the secret.
There's a good lesson in this, though, for people always ask, and I'm sure they ask you, like, how do you get to be you? And your answer is really the answer, which is just dive in and do everything that you're asked to do and do it well, and you're going to be noticed.
Because I got coffee and collected clips, they asked me to write a statement to give me a shot. Because I did okay at that, they asked me to write something else. The coffee and the clip, like... being good at helping the people you're working for, even if it's menial, shows people something about you. And it doesn't all have to, you can be a little cynical. If you're really good at helping someone do their job, they feel indebted to you.
I did a podcast with Theo Epstein, who's mm-hmm. the president of the Cubs, and he was a prodigy in baseball. And he said, I figured out, he was an intern, he was a Yale journalist, and he got an internship with the Baltimore Orioles, and he said, I figured out that if you do that, everybody has like 20% of their job that they don't want to do, and if you could figure out that 20% and do it for them, then you could advance.
That's really smart.
In the organization. And then you went from there, and you got a call, I guess you went to work for John Corzine.
Yeah, so I moved back to New York after the Kerry campaign ended, and Anthony Coley, who's a longtime communications person in D.C., he moved from the Kerry campaign to John Corzine's Senate office. This is John Corzine. He had come from Goldman Sachs, became a senator from New Jersey, went on to become the governor of New Jersey. This is at the time where he was running for governor but still in the Senate. He said, hey, you know, I could use an intern to help me out here. Now, at this point, I'd been out of college for a few months. I bluffed. I said, I can't intern anymore. I need a paying job. Now, I could have made it work. I could have driven down. I'm very lucky that way. I could have stayed with friends and, you know, lived off a little bit of my help from my parents. But I don't know. I said I couldn't do it. I was like, no, I'm done. I wanted to move forward, and I wanted to see what would happen.
Well, needless to say, John Corzine could probably afford you to.
Well, not when you're going to spend. Look, if you got to spend $60 million on ads in New Jersey to get people to vote for you, you don't have anything to spare for junior
for
staff.
Love it.
But they did end up finding me a job. And I ended up getting to be a junior press person within a few weeks. Because John Corzine was running for governor, a lot of his Senate staff was dispersing to other offices. One of those people was, who actually went on to be legislative affairs for Obama, Miguel Rodriguez, was mm-hmm. moving over to Hillary Clinton's office. And he heard through the grapevine that I had written jokes before. And so when Hillary Clinton had to do a roast of Barbara Walters, I got an email from the communications director from Hillary Clinton's office, which like panicked me. I mean, this was so exciting. Like, this was crazy. Saying, we heard you're funny. Would you want to write jokes? I said, I'm hilarious. It's perfect. And I ended up...
Do you remember any of your jokes from the...
I remember there was a joke about running into Rick Lazio at an upstate deli. Beyond that,
her opponent when she ran for the Senate, yeah.
Yeah. And there was a joke about Barbara Walters covering the... somehow being involved in the coverage of Hurricane Katrina. Beyond that, I've retained nothing. She actually ended up not going to the roast because of votes. But I got on the phone with a few joke writers who continue to write jokes for a lot of different Democratic politicians. Al Franken got on the phone, different time. And one of the coolest things for me was I got Al Franken to laugh. Because I really looked up to Al Franken. What happened to Al Franken really broke my heart because I loved him. There's nobody to me that captured the ability to do comedy, move into politics. Like, it's so funny. Like, but I looked up to him. I really did. And to make him laugh, someone whose books I read, I bought a radio to listen to him on Air America Radio the first day Air America launched. Like, I was a fan. He came on Pod Save America, and I was a dope about it because I don't get starstruck. But I was starstruck. Anyway, I made Al Franken laugh, and that meant the world to me. A few weeks later, they hired me to be a junior speechwriter. So
let me ask you a question. You've written jokes for various people, including Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
How does joke writing change according to who you're writing the jokes for? In other words, would you write the same jokes? I mean, obviously, you wouldn't write a joke for Hillary Clinton about being... you know, a black Muslim socialist.
Right, but that wouldn't work.
No. But are there jokes that, you know, do you hear in your head jokes that are Hillary Clinton-style jokes versus Barack? And how was she at delivering jokes?
You know, I struggle to write jokes for Hillary Clinton. It was hard. I think that she and I were never totally in sync. And I didn't understand that till much later. With Hillary Clinton,
because you did write you wrote not just jokes for her, but you became one of her principal speechwriters in the 2008 campaign.
Right, and that was something sort of I learned and got much more comfortable with. You know, with Hillary, I found that it was much easier to find a way to kind of less a joke and more a good line. She liked good old fashioned sound bites. Like one line that I wrote that I actually like. It's cheesy, but I like it. Which is
be unusual, but.
For me to like my own, get high in my own supply. The joke was, this was a good line for Hillary Clinton. It was, John McCain and George W. Bush are two sides of the same coin, and it doesn't amount to a whole lot of change. It's a silly line, but she relished in using it, and it didn't require just delivering a hard punchline. It's just a good soundbite. So I found that I was more successful writing lines like that for her than I was at us having a Venn diagram of what we find funny overlapping. I think in the end, I believe... she knew that people thought I was funny. But I think we always had a little bit of a friction in terms of that.
There's also risk involved in telling jokes.
Yeah.
And she was famously cautious. It I think hurt her in the end that she was. But she didn't strike me as someone who's gonna jump off the diving board on something that was sort of a risky proposition.
You know, one of the things that I actually appreciate about her, and that actually makes it harder to write jokes for her, is she's not meta. She's not big on infusing her speeches with self-awareness. Barack Obama is. Barack Obama, and even today, you know, talking about Trump, he said, how hard is it to call somebody a Nazi, right? That is a perfect kind of way for Barack Obama to break through, but it's analysis. And he does a great job of kind of being above the fray.
He's got a writer's sensibility in that regard.
Right. And I think that kind of tone is not something that Hillary Clinton has been traditionally comfortable in. She's had her moments. A good moment. Remember that moment during the 2008 campaign where she said, and the skies will open and the clouds will part. It's a great moment for her in a way because she did something she doesn't usually do, mm-hmm. which is speak to the conversation about the conversation. Mm-hmm. With President Obama, he was much more comfortable there. He's much more comfortable being wry and observant about the situation we're all in. And he is more willing, I think, to take a risk for jokes. I've thought about it, too. Like, why is it so risky to tell a joke? What is it about a joke bombing that's so much worse than having not had a joke at all? And I think humor is also this very primitive thing. And a joke, especially in a there's a lot of reasons a joke can be funny, and you know, to get too, whatever, pedantic about it. But often a joke is funny because we are surprised to learn that the speaker and the listener share a secret. And the secret is, oh, wow, that was unexpected to me for the same reason it was unexpected to you. You surprised me. Your surprise shows me that you understand me in a fundamental way. We're the same in-group. That's why a joke works. It shows you, look, I'm the same as you. We're on the same page. We have the same context, the same sense of the absurd. When it bombs, it creates such distance because it's saying, you and I, we don't really understand each other. What you find funny, I don't find funny. What you find surprising, I don't find surprising. We don't share a sensibility. Mm-hmm. We're not part of the same team. So I think that's why ultimately it's risky. And President Obama was always willing to go there. Plus, he was extraordinarily adept at delivering jokes.
You had an interesting exchange with Hillary around the issue of being gay.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell that story.
There have been a few times where there have been these moments, especially as a speechwriter. You know, one of the most common questions you get as a speechwriter is, what is it like to work on a speech when you don't agree with it? And it actually doesn't happen that often in the sense that I may be for Medicare for All or something else, or I may not know enough about economics to know what policy is right, but I generally believe in the economic principles of the Democratic Party, and I believe in the social principles of the Democratic Party. So that doesn't come up that much. But on gay rights, it was often true, right? Because there was a long time in which Democratic politicians were in favor of civil unions while making
including both
Clinton and Obama, claiming they weren't for gay marriage. And it was, you know, we could argue about it. I wouldn't argue about it, but it's clearly a dishonest political decision because it was viewed as controversial and that civil unions was as far as you could go because marriage evoked all these other issues and that we had lost a bunch of ballot measures around it. It was unknown. It was an area of fear for.
In fact, in that 2004 race, the Republicans put a bunch of them on states.
Absolutely.
To try and encourage a turnout among evangelical voters.
Yes, an effort led by a closeted gay person named Ken Melman, who led the effort in 2004 that enshrined anti-gay amendments on several constitutions. So,
who later ended up as a supporter of, promoter of mm-hmm. the gay marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Better late than never, pal.
I'm not seeing a lot of forgiveness here. No, go. Keep going.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was a point at which I think she was coming out for civil unions and not being in favor of gay marriage. Now, one thing that was fascinating is in a year, a Democrat going in front of a gay audience and saying, and we need civil unions in this country, was an applause line. Like, you're with us, everyone else is against us, you're for civil unions, yeah. They're against civil unions. But then all of a sudden, there was something changed, and gay rights organizations, gay people, the liberal parts of the Democratic Party said, wait a second, why are we living by this old, we should have gay marriage. Why not?
Right.
Why are we acceding to this Republican argument before we've even begun? And so I remember Hillary Clinton speaking at the Human Rights Campaign and getting a round of applause for civil unions, and then I remember a room of gay activists being silent when she said the same thing maybe 10 months later. Anyway, it was during this period of time that I was writing these speeches, and I was writing about why she was in favor of civil unions and not marriage equality, and I just was like, you know what? I am not so narcissistic as to believe that that simply because I am close to this issue, it's worse, or that I shouldn't do this. Writing the speech, supporting politicians who say the speech, being involved in politics, just being up next to it doesn't make it worse. But I did feel an obligation to just walk into her office and say, just so you know, I'm a gay person and I'm working on the speeches and I'm happy to do it, but you should just know that the person writing them is gay. I just want you to know that. And I walked in and I said that, and she said, oh, Jonathan, I knew months ago.
So you had a good relationship with her.
Yeah, I think so. I think she keeps speechwriters a little bit further away than Barack Obama. I also think that, especially for someone who's had so many people in roles like this for a very long time, you know, I came into that job, I was 23, I didn't know anything. And I think you're a little bit frozen in the way that you first make an impression. And so I think I will always be a kind of awkward, overconfident, under-experienced speechwriter, especially when I'm around Clinton people. You know, the same way when you go home for the holidays, you regress a little bit.
Yes.
So that was always there. But, yeah, I mean, I was there for 3 years more, and it's where I learned so much. I learned from her. I learned from other speechwriters.
Why did she run into the problem she did?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, political problems. I mean, I'm interested in your insights as someone who, you know, has a high regard for her.
You know, I remember there was a policy aide who worked in the Senate. And sometime during the 2008 campaign, she asked to be more involved in the campaign. And I can't remember the exact wording, Hillary said something like, I don't want you involved in all that. I want you here, you know, like, I want you here doing this policy work. And the way she conveyed it, it was as if she was saying, you're good at policy. You're doing the noble part of this. Don't get involved with the mm-hmm. snake part of this. The campaigning mm-hmm. That's why I have the people I have over there who know how to do the attacks and the politics and the electioneering. I want you doing the stuff we're going to do after, the stuff that's
right.
pure and good.
And the stuff that clearly motivated her.
The stuff that motivated her. I have over the last 2 years, I think, been hard on Hillary Clinton because I think I carry around a lot of emotion from what happened. And, you know, in some sense, I emotionally, whether it's fair or not, hold her responsible. You can argue about the facts of it, but I'm saying emotionally, I think mm-hmm. a lot of people feel that. But one thing that always frustrated me, people said, oh, she'll just say anything. She'll do anything. She doesn't believe in anything. This is somebody who cared about children so much, motivated her, empowered her, drove her from the time of being young. Does she have the flaws that people point out? Of course. But you can't say somebody doesn't believe in anything mm-hmm. when you can draw a straight line from working at the Children's Defense Fund, from going door to door to help disabled kids, all the way to what she proposed in 2016. You just can't. You can't. It's more nuanced than that. And I wish that she was able to be the person, the best version of herself in all of these campaigns. But there's a reason she was popular when she was in office and not popular when she campaigned. For whatever reason, she struggles in that setting. Now, I think there's why I don't fully understand. I think there's two Hillary Clintons. There's this sort of noble public servant, and then there's this person whose instinct is not to ask what do I believe, but rather what do I need to say.
I mean, there's a fear factor there.
Yeah,
No, I've seen it. I saw it personally, but she was a great champion for the cause of epilepsy research, which I'm personally and deeply committed to. And she helped my wife start this organization to promote epilepsy research and did many things to help that cause because she saw what happened to children who had to deal with this horrible scourge. And I'll never forget that. So you came over to the Obama.
Yeah.
Team, how was that transition moving? You know, we had this epic struggle for 2 years, and now you're coming over to the Obama White House.
Look, what I said then was, if I knew I would have the same job,
yes.
Either way, I would have been much less passionate about it. So, yeah, I was really nervous. People were like, you should just know, it's cliquey. These guys have all been through something together. And that never fully goes away, right? There's one of the something that was just sort of emotionally a part of the job was knowing that I am here, I am part of the team, I feel embraced by the team. I'm sitting in an office of a company that I founded with Favreau and Vitor, two people that were part of Obama 08.
We're at the worldwide global headquarters of Crooked Media.
We are.
In LA.
Yeah, but it's a little bit like, I don't know, like...
Kid yourself, we all still think of you as alien.
No, I appreciate that. I'm trying to think of what the analogy is, but I can't think of it. But it's something like, you guys all had these stories, these incredible stories. And it's like, wow, that's a good story. That's cool. You guys were all there for that. Nice.
Yeah. But I honestly didn't. I mean, I don't think any of us, I joke, but I don't think anybody felt that way. You fit right in. I always tell people that I had the great good fortune of seeing the forerunner to Pod Save America every single day. We had our wordsmith meetings where we talked about speeches.
I love those meetings. I love those meetings, and I remember how I just didn't want them to end.
Yeah.
They always ended, and I just like, can we just sit here and just shoot the shit for a little bit longer? And you always would, but you had, you had Nurse Ratched outside of the door.
Eric Lesser.
Senator Eric Lesser.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was his job.
Yeah, no.
But it was an extraordinary thing. You guys were all in your 20s.
Yeah.
And, but it was a writer's room.
It was. And one of the things I took away from that, too, is you would always... I felt like your role in those meetings was always to just sort of step back and try to figure out what the heart of what we needed to say was. And it was and sometimes I think you struggled. Sometimes you wouldn't always have it, but sometimes you would just say something so beautiful and simple and true that would come to be the heart of the speech. And a lot of people would ask me, how does polling play into speech writing? How does it work? And there is a distinction between what I think some people who have served a role like yours do and what you did. And there's a lot of political operations where the polling comes in with what messages work, and that just goes right from that page to the writers, to the message operation, to the communication staff. The Barack Obama operation campaign, the White House, sophisticated, data-based, collecting information. And you care about polling and know how polling works and get information from polling, but you would do this extraordinary thing, which is, I don't think I really saw polling information. I don't think you let it come into what you did, although there was one really funny moment where there was a giant binder on your desk labeled polling, and we were working on a speech that said, I don't govern based on the polls. And I was like, wow, how big is the binder if you do govern based on the polls? but the serious point I was making is you had this ability to take in all this data, including kind of mercenary, bloodless polling information, what you're hearing from the news, what's going on television, what the president's thinking, all of that, and find a way to say it that didn't feel political, that felt honest.
Well, I mean, I think we were working for someone who actually believed stuff.
Yeah.
And the main thing was to return to first principles,
Yeah.
I mean, there are other elements of it, but that made it easier.
Yeah.
Remember, I always used to, we used to say, let's go back and look at the convention speech
from
2004, the JJ speech from Iowa in 2007, because these were foundational statements that he believed, and that made it easier. I now know, because now I know all about this math, the secret math life you led, why you always gravitated to these science and technology speeches. That was kind of the niche that you carved out for yourself.
Yeah, I liked writing about science and technology and energy. I liked doing healthcare. I liked doing sort of financial policy speeches, in part because I do feel an affinity for those topics. And I liked the project of, like, the housing crisis. There was a speech that I'm actually proud of. It was early on, in which he was talking about policy around the housing crisis. And it was always such a hard story to tell. And I'm really proud of the beginning of that speech. I don't think it's particularly memorable for people, but for me, it started with one home, and then it went to the brown lawns, and then it went to the community being struggled, and then it went to the revenue of the state, and then it went to what's happening with the financial crisis, then it went what happened to the economy. And you started really small and went bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was really proud of that because it was a hard way to break it down.
This goes back to the mind of a mathematician translating into writing,
yeah,
which is sort of the orderly telling of the story.
Yeah, I think so.
Before we leave this, you were also deeply involved in the writing of these correspondence dinner speeches, gridiron dinner speeches, collective effort. One that you were most involved in may be of historic moment, the complete slaying of Donald Trump at the 2011 correspondence dinner. Talk about that, because I think you were...
Yeah.
You were a major component of that.
So
before I say that, please don't audit his taxes. There were other people involved.
Yeah, audit my taxes if it's what propelled it. I don't want to get into it. 2011, and I don't think we had any idea sitting in that room how important what was going on would be. But this is the weekend where President Obama pillories Trump at the Correspondents' Center. It's also the weekend he's killing Osama bin Laden, or ordering the raid.
Didn't know when we were in his office going over this.
No
this,
idea.
Monologue.
So the week starts. We had produced. This is when Donald Trump was going on about the birth certificates. We'd written a bunch of jokes about the birth certificate, and we were going to use a bunch of videos. We were putting all this together, and then all of a sudden we get this strange call that there's going to be some kind of a press briefing. Unexpected. And I remember Favreau and I saying, what if this is the birth certificate? No. How could that possibly? Why now? Why right now? That'd be so. You're just panicking because it would screw up all our jokes.
And it was.
It was the birth certificate, the long awaited birth certificate. So then that's, I think, Tuesday or Wednesday. We're now scrambling to revise. At first, we think we have to throw everything out. We realize actually a lot of this still works because now the birth certificate exists. We can just change it. We come up with a really funny way to introduce President Obama as I Am a Real American with a song from Hulk Hogan. We write a bunch of other stuff, but we can't get time to see the president. Can't get any time. We then think, oh, you know what? Trump's going to be there. We're going to go after him. I get on the phone with Judd Apatow, who would help from time to time. We come up with this great idea around attacking Donald Trump for thinking he could be president when he was the host of The Apprentice. We work it out. We go through it. We finally get time with President Obama, but it's not until the day of the dinner. Normally, you have to get in Thursday, Friday, because
right.
What if he has changes? What if he wants to do things? But we couldn't get time. He's got a meeting with Afghanistan. He's got a meeting with the Afghanistan team. He's got to go to a place that had been hit by storms. He has to go to NASA.
Right.
We couldn't get time. And I remember we're standing outside the Oval Office on Saturday, the day of the thing. You were having lunch with him, delaying us even further. We were so frustrated. Then we find out, actually, we can't even go in after the Axe lunch because he's got to do a secure call with the general.
Right.
And I say to Katie Johnson, the president's assistant, this is important. These are the jokes. And, of course, there's this national security staffer standing outside, very nervous. We now know because he was patching through calls related to the raid to kill bin Laden. And we say, well, let's test the jokes out on him. Start testing jokes on him. He's not laughing.
Yeah.
This guy's too serious. Well, forget him. Door opens. President calls us in. He's just throwing a football, totally relaxed. We sit down. We go through all the jokes. He's pleased. He likes everything we're doing. He likes making fun of Trump. He makes one change.
He eliminates a bin Laden joke.
And we think, well, whatever. You got the electoral votes. You know,
right.
The joke is worse, but you're in charge. What are we going to do? We make the changes. We get out okay. We don't have to throw everything out. He delivers the speech. It works really, really well. The Trump jokes work really, really well. Seth Meyers gets up there. He pillories Trump, goes even further. And that also works really well. And then that was it. That was the last we heard of Donald Trump. Anyway, the next day, we find out that on Sunday, all these reporters with their 5 o'clock shadow and hangovers from having been at the brunches and the dinners the night before all get hauled into their studios, because that was when we found out that President Obama had ordered the raid to kill bin Laden. And, you know, the thing I've said to you is the three of us, me, you, and Faz, we walked into the Oval Office and we were a couple of Seinfelds who'd wandered into a Tom Clancy novel and nobody told us.
No. No, but it did make me feel about better about him cutting that joke. I think that was good judgment on his part.
Yes, I think you tempt fate when you joke about somebody you're in the process of ordering the death of.
You left the White House and you went to Hollywood, and your goal was to become a screenwriter here.
Yeah.
And you had like immediate success. You got a show on NBC immediately.
It was crazy. So I left. I had this moment where I realized, like, you know, I no longer was imagining what it would be like to move further in politics. I was now imagining what it would be like to tell jokes and write comedy. And it's like, well, you know what? I should follow that. And I wanted to. And so I left.
Having launched the Donald Trump campaign, you thought, man, I can make a career of this.
Well, they hadn't put me on the payroll yet, so I needed to make money doing something. But so I came out to LA. I had to finally, like, sort of force myself, because I was working for the government. I didn't have, you know, a lot of resources. I was just like, well, I can't leave unless I know what my job's going to be, but I can't find out what my job is going to be unless I finally tell John that I'm thinking about leaving. So I finally bit the bullet and I told him. He was understanding.
John Favreau.
Yeah. And I moved out to LA. I thought I was going to take some time to learn how to write a script. I thought I'd do some stand-up comedy, but within a few weeks, I had, by luck and happenstance, got teamed up with Josh Gad, this guy Jason Weiner, who directed Modern Family, and they had this idea for a show about a first family, a zany first family, and said, all right, I'll learn how to write by doing that. I thought nothing would happen with it. We'd just sell it and nothing would happen. But within a few weeks, it was going to pilot. The first TV script I ever wrote was a script that got shot. So it was a 1600 pen, one perfect season, cult classic, beloved by everyone except the
critics.
In the Lovett family.
Yeah. So how was that? You had extraordinary success at 27 or something.
Yeah.
And you have a ratings failure, and
yeah,
you get canceled after a year. It's like the heights and the depths of Hollywood all in a year.
Yes. It was what I realized after is that because it came so easy, it being taken away didn't seem so bad. You know, I thought I was going to have a chance to, like, I had been going so hard from the time I was 23. 23, I get this job as a Hillary Clinton speechwriter. I don't know how to write a speech. I don't know how to do this. I have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not great at admitting I don't know what I'm doing. So I do all the mistakes you make when you don't know what you're doing. You panic, you cordon yourself off, you hide from the problem. You finally force yourself to learn. So I really grew in those years, but I worked really hard. There were periods of time where I was the only speechwriter, a period of time where there was more than what any of us could do. Then right after that ends, you guys hire me. I move over to the White House. I have three crazy years at the White House, again, going really hard, learning, feeling all the stress around that job. I think I'm going to have a chance to unwind and kind of take a break. All of a sudden, I'm making a TV show for the first time, again, feeling out of my depth, feeling like I am in the deep end and learning while doing, you know, whatever, the building, mm-hmm, building the plane in the air. That finally all ends. And I think that was a really good, I was really sad, but it was such a good time for me because the show gets canceled. And all of a sudden, for the first time, I have some money. When you make a TV show, you make some money, enough money that you don't have to worry for a while. So all of a sudden, I have savings from having made a TV show. I have all these opportunities because when you make a TV show your first time out of the gate, people think, let's see what else he has to do. And for the first time, I was able to just sort of step back and think about, what do I want? How am I going to handle it? What's it for? And it was, I think, a scary time. I think it was depressed during that time, but it was good.
And now, having provoked Donald Trump to a campaign for president, you guys are trying to expiate your sin.
Mm-hmm.
And you've created this empire, this, as I said to you the other day, a cult. Here at Crooked Media,
mm-hmm,
and Pod Save America and all of its offshoots, Love It and Leave It being one, mm-hmm, of them, one of the popular offshoots of Pod Save America. Tell me sort of how you think of it. I talked to John. I said, do you think of this as journalism? He said, no. I think of it as activism. How do you think about what you've done? Because you've got an enormous following. I mean, I've got a young assistant who hangs on every word of you, and I'm like astonished knowing you guys as I do.
It's all been very surprising. You know, so the election happens. John, Tommy, and I decide that we want to stay in politics and we don't want to go back to treating politics like a hobby. I think one of the lessons I had in the 3 years between making 1600 Pen and the 2000 and the end of the 2016 campaign was realizing that I was kidding myself about what I cared about. I could get myself to care about writing. I could get myself to care about entertainment, but it was a fight to convince myself it was actually politics. It was a fight to convince myself that I still was doing something, contributing. I think that it was a bug I hadn't lost. When we set out to do it, I think that there were two pieces of it. There was the fact that Donald Trump winning was a national emergency. It was a national emergency that he got the nomination, but it was a national emergency and crisis, and one that would not end. And then the other piece of it was feeling as though the conversation around politics was broken. And those two things together, I think, were what propelled us, that we wanted to have a less serious, honest conversation about what was happening in the country from a liberal point of view, but intellectually honest. At least, you know, you can call us biased, you can say we're wrong, but we're saying what we believe. And one that helped people who were about to go through something traumatic. You know, one of the things I come back to a lot is there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of maliciousness and sourness in our politics right now. Twitter makes all that worse. Twitter makes everybody act as if they're invulnerable while all performing as if they can be wounded at any moment. But what's undergirding a lot of that is I think people are going through something really hard right now. I think that there's a lot of emotion right beneath the surface. And that's how I feel all the time. I think that beneath the anger is we're heartbroken. We're a heartbroken country.
I think there's something else beneath the surface, and I think you guys have touched it, and that is a sense of determination. And, you know, we brood about where we are, but the flip side of Trump is that nobody ever says now elections don't matter.
Yeah.
People are committed, and you see all this activism all over the country, and you guys are in the middle of fomenting some of that and encouraging it and supporting it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But the other side of that is I do think people have woken up. And when we set out, when we started the company, what we said was we want to build something that entertains, informs, and inspire action. And at first that was just a slogan.
A triplet.
Yes. Yeah, just writing. But the more we thought about it, the more that became a subtly important and actually challenging mission. It's actually very difficult to entertain, inform, and inspire action, to do it in the right balance all the time, or at least across the network, make sure you're constantly driving people towards being involved, caring, participating, taking all this heartbreaking stuff that's happening and turning it into something positive. The way we think about it is that there's a lot of punditry, there's a lot of comedy, there's a lot of news out there that treats everyone like cynical observers. That the news often talks to you as if you know everything. You're an omniscient political operative who knows what side you're on and can't be convinced. But this news is to help you understand how the regular people feel. That's why we cover the poll. That's why we talk about how things are playing. It's not about persuading you. You're unpersuadable. You're a perfect observer. You're a cynic. This is for the other people. But there is no news for the other people. There's no news that actually helps everybody else who isn't a cynical observer, who's actually a frustrated participant. And to us, I think what we have been trying to do is speak to people who are or should be frustrated participants. And that's how we feel. And I think that's what people often relate to. And, you know, we have a fun conversation, we joke around, but ultimately, I think what we come back to again and again is it would be very easy right now to walk away, but you can't.
But you are speaking to a universe of people who share values and a point of view. You're not speaking to the entire universe of Americans.
No, but the most important people we can reach are not Republicans to convince to change their mind. It's people who are not participating who need to be convinced to participate. And people that are, who share our point of view, but maybe feel disconnected, uninvolved, outside of the political process, in part because that's what a propaganda apparatus exists to convince them is true, plus also the failure of Democrats to speak to the tens of millions of non-voters who could help make sure that Democrats win more elections.
You guys are doing everything you can to defeat Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that if you defeat Donald Trump, you lose a bit of your reason for being.
Yeah, sure. Great problem to have.
I'm just telling you to plan ahead, that's all.
No, I think that, look, what I said before is still true. Donald Trump is an emergency, but Donald Trump didn't happen in a vacuum. There were a set of conditions that made someone this monstrous. There were a set of conditions that made it possible for someone like this to rise to power. Some of those will exist long after he's gone. You know, I think a lot of what people, one thing I've noticed, especially as a lot of people have become more invested in politics over the last 2 years than they were before, not saying they weren't paying attention, not even saying they weren't voters, but they're paying attention mm-hmm. more, is when you're paying attention, you see the problems more. And there's a lot of people who have been paying attention to the news who are trying to solve in 2 years, 30-year problems. And that's not how it works. And so a lot of the conditions that led to Trump will still be there. One of them will be the broken conversation around politics. Do I think that after Trump is gone, hopefully soon, people will go back to normal a bit? Of course, that's a good thing. It's a good thing.
It's exhausting right now.
Yeah, we're in the middle of an autoimmune response as a country. I mean, this is, you know, we are in a panic response. And when you're in a panic response, the blood goes to where you need it. It goes to your muscles. It goes to your nervous system. But it doesn't go to your brain, right? We are in a panic. And at some point that will fade, and that's a good thing. It should fade. What makes me hopeful more than anything else is that there will be a moment after Trump is gone, when everyone is still paying attention. And in that moment, I believe we will be able to do more than we thought possible.
Well, what a good place to end on a hopeful note.
Yeah.
Always good to be with you. Working with you guys was one of the highlights of my life, really. I enjoyed it so much. And I'm proud to see that you guys are still out there and still making a difference. So,
well,
good to be with you, brother.
I always think so fondly of our time working together at the White House. And I feel so honored that I got to work with you, because there aren't people who care as much as you, who are as smart as you. You just don't come across them that often. And I learned a lot from you, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, for that, I'm glad we ran over. Good to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.